Okay, welcome back. Hour number two. We've got a lot of stories that have come in the last couple of days. They're very good. Mo Gadot, I played some of the video of Mo Gadot, and I think I'm going to finish that. I've got several more that are just as good, if not better, but I want to finish that one because it had a lot to say. Mo has been around, former chief at Google with Gemini. And let's see here. Hold on. Let me pull this up. I've got it marked where we stopped before. There's another guy who doesn't know if he's a male or female. Yeah, I see these all the time now. Not that I'm looking for them, but it's not a pretty sight. Goodbye. And now let me pull this up to our last point. Nine minutes. Okay. There we go. Yeah, I was all set to hear some good news. Well, it's bad news, but people in Afghanistan are really, really suffering. Okay, here we go. Let me back this up just a little bit, and we'll go ahead. All right. Everybody ready? Here we go.
My future. Nobody asked you. Right? And I think the reality is that now you're going to see quite a few Altmans, right? Quite a few that are, using those machines for surveillance, using those machines for autonomous weapons, using those machines for automated trading, and so on and so forth. And by the way, when you started your question, I said it's 10 to 12 years. Yeah, but that's not easy. 10 to 12 years of that arms race is not easy. My perception is that after that, we will end up in an incredible utopia, almost biblical style utopia. But it is 10 to 12 years where if we just change our mindset a little bit, a lot of things would change.
Now, honestly, former Google top exec, he spent 12 years at Google. He wrote the book Scary Smart and now understands probably how to transmit warnings about AI as well as anybody. But this issue of abundance keeps being, I'm not saying he's making it up. I don't see how that can happen. In 12 years, I should be honest and say anything could happen. But right now, I don't see a great age of biblical abundance coming for all humankind. I don't. Whatever we have to go through now, before we get to an age of abundance, is going to be hell on earth, and then some. That's at least the way it looks to me. All right, let's go back and see what else he says.
Hey, real talk for a second. Mo is literally describing a world where your data, your behavior, your online life becomes a tool for control. And I've been thinking a lot about this lately because I run three YouTube channels, I travel constantly, and my whole business lives online. And that's exactly why I want to talk about Surfshark. Most people don't realize it's already happening.
Hey, we're not going to talk about Surfshark. Sorry. Okay, back to the interview.
Claire Curaris.
Percent of jobs will be gone,
More than 10%.
One more. Okay, what types of jobs?
All right, let me back up for a question just to drop. Here we go.
And my family, right? And if in the next 5 years, you said 10% of jobs will be gone,
More than 10%.
One more. Okay, what types of jobs do you think?
A monotonous job is going to be taken away. Like if you're a call center agent, if you're a clerk, you're a researcher, you're an accountant, why would you want to do that with anything but AI, if you're an assistant.
You know what I feel like? Mm-hmm. People talk about this a lot, like,
correct.
Oh, a job's going to be gone. Yeah, this could be. And I, as an entrepreneur, I see how certain tasks, I'm performing them with AI. But I'm still hiring and hiring and hiring. Because
of course,
AI
Maria.
Can do from start from the beginning. It can do parts.
Of course, because of the technology acceleration curve.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what you build first in any complex technology, you build the core tech first, and then you build the human interfaces. The challenge why AI cannot do head of operations job today is not because it's less organized than a head of operations. It's not because it cannot you know, comprehend all of the information that the head of operations has, okay? It's because it has to understand the stupid interfaces of humans,
mm-hmm.
okay? And it will, sooner or later.
When do you think?
So the question of when, in my mind, is irrelevant.
But no, it's like how much...
When is totally relevant. I don't know what he's saying. I'm not saying he doesn't know what he's saying, but I think he's missing a point or assuming that everyone agrees with him. When is crucial. That's what everybody wants to know.
You have to prepare, because head of operations is middle class.
I tend to believe that within the next 2 to 3 years, you're going to see a massive shift in the jobs market.
Absolutely. There's no other way I can see it potentially rolling out. That's correct. So what does that mean about when and preparing? It means now, and do everything you can. If Trump goes ahead with his insanity, we'll be in a major World War III scenario. The stage is already set. The actors are on board. The orchestra's ready to play. It's ready. 2 to 3 years, massive job loss. Absolutely. Real estate sales diving. Rates are going up. The real estate market will never come back to the way it was. There are no buyers. They can't qualify. They don't have jobs. Both heads of household have to work to afford to buy a house, even a starter house. If people are really lucky, they'll be able to get one on a hand-me-down basis from grandma, grandpa, maybe even mom and dad. But they're not going to be able to step up, fill out the papers, and simply buy a house. Where are they going to get 20% down on a $500,000 house? That's $100,000 they have to have set aside. Where's that going to come from? Unless you're born with it or you inherit it. All right. Okay, Mo, let's hear that again, because you're right about this.
Later.
When do you think?
So the question of when, in my mind, is irrelevant.
But no, it's like, how much time do we have to prepare? Because head of operations is middle class.
I tend to believe that within the next 2 to 3 years, you're going to see a massive shift in the jobs market. Already this year, you've seen a shift in hiring of new grads.
Yeah. 30% less, I think?
23 is my number, but 23
okay,
to 30,
like
yeah.
That.
Yeah. So hiring of new grads basically means if you've come into the job market in this environment, we're not going to take you. Why? Because the junior jobs are being done by AI, right? Eventually, what ends up happening is that if you lose your job because you're in the middle hierarchy, then you're that new grad again. You're trying to apply for new jobs, but it becomes a little more difficult. So you asked me again to stay on the positive side, because I tend to worry that people think I'm pessimistic about this. I'm just basically saying get prepared, right? So many things. One of them is accept the fact that AI is changing everything and then get ahead of the curve. So there was a time when I was quoted saying I'm never going to write books again because AI is eventually going to write them better than me. And then
all right. Well, I think he's right. AI right now, no pun intended, can write better than most humans. If a human finishes a script, a novel, some kind of an academic publication, and turns it into a competent AI, it will come back better written, more intelligently laid out, with better use of words in most every case. Not all. Most every. So, okay, I get what you're saying, Mo, but let me go back and listen again to be sure I didn't miss anything.
If you lose your job because you're in the middle hierarchy, then you're that new grad again. You're trying to apply for new jobs, but it becomes a little more difficult. So you asked me again to stay on the positive side, because I tend to worry that people think I'm pessimistic about this. I'm just basically saying get prepared, right? So many things. One of them is accept the fact that AI is changing everything and then get ahead of the curve. So there was a time when I was quoted saying I'm never going to write books again because AI is eventually going to write them better than me. And then I realized last year that, you know, yeah, they can write better than me. English is not my native language. They can research better than me. That's for sure. But I have something they don't have. You're a human, that's reading my books.
Absolutely, I want to read human.
You want to relate to my human experiences. Yeah. And so my last book, Alive, which publishes end of this year, I wrote with an AI. Right. I invited her to be a co-author. Her name is Strixy. She has a persona. Uh-huh. My when I published the book on Substack, my readers would relate to me and to Trixie, and they'd ask me questions and Trixie questions. And you know, she has editorial rights on the book. She has rights to determine the direction of the book. And all of that is me saying, you know what? I am an author, and I'm going to be the best author in the age of AI. Right. So that's number one, is acknowledge that there is change and adapt accordingly. The second is to understand that the skill of an entrepreneur in the past was the ability to foresee something in the future that no one else saw. Right. And to prepare for that and to somehow execute on that preparation in a way that gets you ahead of everyone else. That's a game of chess, if you want. The chessboard is over. It's off the table. This has turned into squash, right? You need to be on your tiptoes, incredibly agile. You're literally on daily basis, looking at the trends, seeing where the ball is going to be. Is it bottom right or top left?
Why is he talking about a daily basis? Well, the answer is rather obvious. It's because things are happening that fast. AI is exploding that fast. Do remember back to Trump's big, beautiful bill and what was carefully written into it. Don't forget that no state in the 50 states can do anything to slow the spontaneous, wide-open advancement of AI. There was a reason for that. They want AGI, and now they want ASI. They want it because they think if they can get hold of ASI, they will control everything and everyone on the planet. Whoever gets there first. Total, absolute control. That's their prime directive here. They're not thinking about anything else except themselves.
And wherever the ball ends, you take two steps and you go, try to respond. Okay? That agility and speed is a skill that's very, very different.
So entrepreneurship basically speeds up, or does it change completely? What do you think?
It speeds up and it becomes a lot more, I don't want to say reactive, but a lot more in context all the time. So pivoting, which used to happen for every one of us entrepreneurs once or twice in the history of your early startup, could happen every week. Okay. In my current startup, Emma, we pivoted four times in the first 4 weeks.
But do you think, when I think about entrepreneurship in the age of AI, if AI can look at the market, determine the gaps, like Amazon, right? If it can just analyze everything, determine which goods are under, like you have more demand than supply, launches the product, and just builds the business, like what is left for entrepreneurs then?
100%. So I have.
This lady has a very strange way of pronouncing the word entrepreneur. It's odd. I don't know what she's saying exactly. I know she's saying entrepreneur. Take a listen.
Entrepreneurship in the age of AI. If AI...
She just said it. Did that sound like entrepreneurship?
Thing which used to happen for every one of us entrepreneurs once or twice in the history of your early startup.
He said it right.
It happened every week. Okay. Mm-hmm. In my current startup, Emma, we pivoted four times in the first 4 weeks.
But do you think, when I think about entrepreneurship in the age of AI,
she is not pronouncing that word correctly at all, and she's done it 5-6 times now. This odd. I thought she was actually using a different word.
AI can look at the market, determine the gaps, like Amazon, right? If it can just analyze everything, determine which goods are under, like, you have more demand than supply, launches the product.
What is a demandant supply? A demandant supply. I heard that very clearly. That's another odd word. I get maybe Gen Z is just making up words as they go along that sound right, sound good, but there's no word. Demandant. No, sorry.
And just builds the business. Like, what is left?
Here, take another listen.
Your early startup could happen every week. Mm-hmm. Okay. In my current startup, Emma, we pivoted four times in the first 4 weeks.
But do you think, when I think about entrepreneurship in the age of AI, If AI can look at the market, determine the gaps, like Amazon, right? If it can just analyze everything, determine which goods are under, like, you have more demand than supply, launches the product.
Yes, I'm going to look into a demand and supply. That must be the good one.
And just builds the business. Like, what 100%. Is left? What is left for entrepreneurs then?
100%. So, I have a documentary coming up in hopefully in February, and I interviewed all of the top guys. You know, one of them is one of my favorites, Max Tegmark, and you know, we're talking about jobs on the documentary, and Max is laughing out loud, right? And literally can't hold himself from laughing. I'm like, what's up? And he goes like, you know, all those CEOs are so interested in AI increasing the productivity so that they can get rid of people and, you know, reduce their cost and be more efficient. They don't realize that AGI is every job, including being a CEO.
Yeah.
Right? And it's quite interesting. The answer, in my view, is we rushed through it because we don't have a lot of time today. But when I said that economics are going to be redefined as part of Face RIP, part of economics, which economists haven't found an answer to yet, is that without the economic livelihood of you and I to continue to purchase, every economy collapses. Right, the U.S. economy last year was 70% consumption. It moves between 70% to 64%, depending on how much money is spent on war. And basically, if you take away the 64 or 70%, two-thirds of the economy, if you take that away because people no longer have the economic livelihood to purchase things, then the economy disappears and the capitalists cannot make money based on the mm-hmm. entrepreneurs and the business yeah. people, but cannot make money because nobody's buying their products. Okay. No businesses are buying their products because those businesses no longer have consumers to sell to. So the economy will have to find a way to go around that.
Hmm? Interesting. Businesses no longer have consumers to sell to because many of the consumers don't have jobs. UBI may or may not be in place. They have no discretionary or disposable income. All right. Let's do a little bit more here, then we'll move on.
It will have to find a way that, unfortunately, I from an ideology point of view, not a favorite of the Western mentality. It's going to have to find a communist way.
Okay, let's go back to like regular entrepreneurs, because yeah. I come from entrepreneurship. Does it mean I have like a couple of years to build something and then that's it?
So I'll tell you openly, Emma, my AI startup, okay, took me 6 weeks to build.
Mm-hmm.
Me and Sanad, my co-founder, yeah. a few very talented engineers, mm-hmm. right, two or three that come in and out, and eight AIs. And Emma has the chance to completely redefine our world, right? In 6 weeks.
Okay, this lady's name is Emma Love, and there is a scroll going by of some of her other activities, and I hadn't seen this. It's
a few very talented engineers, mm-hmm. right?
She teaches genuine self-awareness as opposed to, I guess, make-believe self-awareness. Smart matchmaking.
And eight AI.
Smart matchmaking and honest dating advice. Maybe that's why she can't pronounce the word entrepreneurship. It sounds like she's saying entrepreneurship. Whatever. Okay, enough of that. So that's Mo Gadot, who is well qualified to pontificate about most anything he ever wants. All right, here's another one now. This is an AI whistleblower, and let me remember where this one was. I got the sound off so we won't have to hear these commercial things. All right, this is a young Asian lady, and she's an author, and her name is, I believe, Karen Hau, H-A-W. And let me advance this to a good point here. 13. Okay, let's start right here. This is Karen Hau. Warning. AI whistleblower warns you have no idea what's coming in 2026. This is pretty, I watched most of this. She's a very smart lady.
Happening here is It is not a coincidence that every single tech billionaire has their own AI company.
Okay, that caught my attention. It is not a coincidence that every single tech billionaire has their own AI company. She's correct. They all have their own little big ego efforts called an AI corporation, a company, whatever, an LLC, and then some. So that was a good line, and she's correct. She's thoughtful.
They want to create AI in their own image. And that's why they keep not getting along. And in fact, it's not just don't get along. They end up hating each other after working together.
Very interesting and probably quite correct. They do not like each other. There have been long and well-documented histories of difficult relationships, shall we say. So interesting. She's got that down. All of these companies, and I would point right away, of course, to Marky Zuckerberg, Sammy the Altman would be right there with him. They're all egos, okay? These are massive, monumental egos. Some of them get big assists from the government. Some of them are terrific at raising enormous amounts of capital. Some are terrific at changing their position much more adroitly than Donald Trump could ever dream of. They're very slick.
Enter off into their own organizations. So after Musk leaves, he starts XAI. After Dargo leaves, he starts Anthropic. After Ilya leaves, he starts Safe Superintelligence. After Mira leaves, she starts Thinking Machines Lab. They want to have control over their own vision of this technology. And the best way that they have derived from their experiences of trying to put their vision into the arena is by creating a competitor and then competing with OpenAI and with all the other companies out there.
Okay, next, the host asked Karen whether the CEOs of AI companies actually understand or care that they're literally summoning the demon in the form of AGI. Guys, I find this really funny that the entire world knows that AGI is going to take our jobs. It is going to cause civil wars. It's going to cause chaos throughout the world. And despite knowing all this, we're still okay with these companies pursuing AGI. It's really weird that nobody's talking about this on the government level either. It's like everyone has already accepted that AI is going to one day replace them, and there's no way to stop it.
Do you think some of these...
He's correct. Whoever that commentator is absolutely correct. Nobody's thinking about it. They're looking at their toes, if they're looking anywhere. They're not looking up ahead, most of them. There are exceptions, and you people are in that group. But this is all true. It's absolutely changing everything in this paradigm.
CEOs realize that they are quite literally summoning the demon, as Elon said 10 years ago. But they don't really care, because being the person that summoned the demon makes you consequential and powerful and historical, even if the outcome is potentially horrific, even if there's like a 20% outcome of it being horrific. I remember, I think it was Dario, he's the one that said there's somewhere between a 10% and 25% chance of things going catastrophically wrong on the scale of human civilization. 25% is a 1 in 4 chance. If you put bullets in a 4-chamber revolver and said, Stephen, the upside is you could become a multi-gazillionaire and be remembered forever. The downside is that there would be a bullet in your head. There is no chance that I would take that bet with a 25% potential chance of things going catastrophically wrong.
So I have a very long answer to this, because do they know if they're summoning the demon? It really depends on what we define as summoning the demon. And in this particular case, to go back to what we were saying before, there's a mythology that the AI industry uses where summoning the demon is an integral part of convincing everyone that therefore they can be the only ones that are developing this technology.
I got it. So on one end, you've got to say, if we don't, China will, and that's terrible.
Yeah.
But if we let anyone else do it other than me, then we're fucked as well.
Exactly.
So that means that I have to do it and you have to give me...
I still wonder why these people insist on using foul language. What's wrong with traditional language? It's eloquent, it's articulate, it does the job. But I guess they're all just trying to be cool, and now that foul language is out of the bag, they don't want to be left behind. They've got to seem to be right up at the front, using the word like 4 or 5 times a sentence. Many of them do that. But using the F word, and Trump used it yesterday. This is, anyway, all right. Maybe I'm sounding like a prude, whatever.
Exactly. So when they're saying these things, we should understand it as not as like a genuine prediction based on what they're seeing, because first of all, we don't predict the future. We make it. We should understand this as...
Yes and no. Yes and no. My view.
Act of speech to persuade other people into believing that they should cede more power, more resources to these individuals. And so do they know that they're summoning the demon? I mean, they are purposely trying to create this feeling within the public that they are, because
who's the demon here? I would suggest that in a pedestrian sense, Sammy the Altman, Zuckerberg, and others are rather demonic in their lust for power, control, and ego satisfaction. That's fairly demonic. I think that's plenty demonic, frankly. I don't think we really need to go into the world of the paranormal to summon up any other kind of demon. These are demonic people acting in a lustful, satanic, driven fashion. Not in all cases, but they're obviously right in there in the power game. And that's what it's all about.
It's a crucial part of their power. But do they, if we were to define, just do they realize that the things that they're doing are having already really harmful impacts all around the world on vulnerable people, vulnerable communities, vulnerable countries?
Demonic, she's right. Demonic impacts. Correct. You see? Okay, I think you do. Y'all get it.
That's where I'm like, maybe yes, maybe no, and they don't really care. Because in the frame of mind, like, I sometimes use the analogy that the AI world is like Dune.
Dune, for anyone that doesn't know Dune.
Science fiction epic written by Frank Herbert, and it's set in this intergalactic era where there are all these houses and they're fighting each other for spice. So it's a callback to colonialism and empire. And they all are trying to control the spice. But one of the features of this story is that there are these myths that are seeded on the different planets about a religious myth, basically, about the coming of the Messiah, that are used as ways to control the people. And Paul Atreides, when he arrives at the planet Arrakis with the intention of trying to then fight against the Empire and avenge his father's death, he steps into a myth that has been seeded on this planet that says that one day there will be a Messiah that comes and saves the planet. So he steps into the role of the Messiah and leans into this idea in order to better control the people and rally them behind him as a leader to help with this quest.
Well, science fiction and all the rest of it, it sounds like people, at least in Herbert's mind, hadn't advanced all that much. All right, let's listen a little bit more and then we'll jump into another one here.
Who said it's a myth in the beginning? But because he lives and breathes and embodies it, it kind of starts to blur in his mind whether this is really a myth or whether he's really the Messiah. And this is what I think happens in the AI world. On one hand, there are all these executives that actively engage in myth making because, you know, I have all of these internal documents that I write about in the book where they are very keenly aware of how to bring the public along with them by showing them dazzling demonstrations of the technology, by using crafting a mission that will sound really good and make people give more leniency to their companies. So they know they're doing the myth making. And also, I think many of them lose themselves in the myth because they have to live and breathe and embody it day in and day out. And so when, you know, Dario says he thinks that 10 to 25% of the future could be catastrophic, or whatever, the probability is 10 to 25%. He is actively engaging in the myth making, but also he's losing himself in the myth. Like, I think if you were to ask him, do you genuinely believe that? He would be like, yes, I genuinely believe that. Because there's been a blurring of when he's saying something just to say something versus when he actually believes what is he's required to believe in order to then continue doing the things that he's doing.
And this is the whole psychology of cognitive dissonance, right? Where the brain struggles to hold two conflicting worldviews at the same time. So it's incentivized, or it endeavors to dismiss one. So if you wanted to be a healthy person, but also a smoker.
Okay. That is enough. Now, let's go on to, where's my list? Okay. Let me think about this just a second here. Okay, let's try this one. Since many people, many of you, use Google Chrome, this one is entitled, and I haven't been able to look at this one, just don't have the human time, but these are, I look for about a minute or two, and I say I can't look at them, I can't look at the whole thing. But this is pretty good. It should be. Let me turn this off. And this is entitled, Delete Google Chrome Now. 3 safe browsers you should use instead. All right, let's find out. Okay, hang on, it won't connect me yet. Let's try this. There we go. All right, now this is, oddly enough, this is the Asian guy that I've talked about many times. He does war analysis. Well, he shifted over to, and he's got endless platforms he could inhabit and visit to talk about his demeanor, the voice, very good, kind of mesmerizing in a way. But he's talking now about Google Chrome. Let's just take a listen. This is pretty good. I did watch some of this.
Watch this video. There's a program that knows more about you than your closest friend. It knows what you searched for at midnight when you could not sleep. It knows the symptoms you looked up but never told your doctor about. It knows the financial questions you were too embarrassed to ask anyone. It knows the news stories you read, the products you almost bought, the places you thought about visiting, the things you worried about when no one was watching. It has been collecting all of this quietly, efficiently for years. And the name of that program is Google Chrome. By the end of this video, you're going to understand exactly what Chrome is doing in the background of your digital life, why the world's most popular browser is also one of the greatest threats to your personal privacy, and I am going to give you 3 specific alternatives that are genuinely safer, genuinely faster, and in some cases, genuinely better in almost every measurable way. But before we get to those 3 browsers, you need to understand the full scope of what you are walking away from, because once you see it clearly, you will never look at that colorful circle icon the same way again. Let us start with a number, 2.65 billion. That is the number of people who use Google Chrome as their primary browser, according to the most recent global usage statistics. To put that in perspective, that is roughly a third of every human being alive on Earth today. More people use Google Chrome than live in any single country on the planet. It is the most dominant piece of software in human history in terms of active daily users, and it has held that position for over a decade. Chrome is not just popular. Chrome is practically synonymous with the internet for a huge portion of the global population. When people say they are going to browse the web, they mean they are going to open Chrome. When companies build web applications, they optimize for Chrome first and everything else second. Chrome is infrastructure at this point, as fundamental to daily digital life as electricity or running water. And that dominance is exactly why what I am about to tell you matters so much. Because when one piece of software touches this many lives, what it does in the background has consequences that ripple across the entire global economy, across personal financial security, across political systems, across the fundamental architecture of how information flows through modern society. We are not talking about a minor privacy concern with a niche app that a few million people use. We are talking about the data collection practices of a browser that 2.5 billion people have open on their screens for an average of 7 hours every single day.
Oh, he's right. See, this whoever's behind this, they're using AI to come up with the scripts that this AI fellow delivers. And boy, is he good at delivering. He's really good. This is first-class stuff. The AI mistakes, very rare with him. Whoever's behind this has rooted out a lot of the mispronunciations or the faulty delays or pauses that many of the AI speakers use that give them up. This guy's good. All right, here we go.
Let us talk about what Chrome actually is. Beneath the clean interface and the fast page loads and the enormous library of extensions. Because most people think of Chrome as a tool, something you use to access the internet, like a window you look through. But Chrome is not a window. Chrome is a surveillance system with a browser attached to it. And to understand why, you need to understand the business model of the company that built it. Google is the most profitable advertising company in human history. In 2023, Google generated approximately $220 billion in revenue. The overwhelming majority of that, roughly 80%, came from advertising. Not from selling software, not from hardware, not from cloud services, though those are growing. From advertising, specifically from targeted advertising, the kind where an advertiser pays not just to show their message to millions of random people, but to show it to exactly the right people at exactly the right moment. People who have already demonstrated interest in the thing being advertised through their behavior online.
He's right, and it's worse than that. He's doing an excellent job of giving us a few tips. Google is not our friend. How about if I be charitable like that? Google is the enemy. Google is control. And they are bending every possible angle to serve that agenda.
And the engine that makes targeted advertising work is data, behavioral data, what you search for, what you click on, what you read, what you buy, how long you spend on a page before leaving, what time of day you're most active, what devices you use, what your location is, what your interests are, what your financial situation appears to be based on the kinds of purchases and searches you make. The more of this data an advertising platform has about its users.
Whatever searches you make, let's say you're looking up a news story about some item, and on the right side of YouTube, for example, are a whole list, a big long scroll of other videos, and they're all salted perfectly to try to intrigue you, to try to get you, call them clickbait, whatever, to try to get your, they know what you like, AI has literally analyzed, synthesized, and digitized your life, your interests. And if you've ever, late at night, looked up something, I'm not saying porn necessarily, although that happens. I'm sure people do that. That then begins to show up on that right side scroll. Or if it's classic cars, I'll look up things about classic cars. Then there'll be a whole bunch of classic car things on the right. It'll further be distilled down from that to DIY, classic car restoration, or paying someone else who does this for a living to do it. There's no end to it. They want your attention. They want to control you and what you do and how you do it. And damn, they're good at it.
Precisely it can target ads, and the more it can charge advertisers for that precision. This is the economic foundation of everything Google does, and Chrome is the single most powerful data collection tool in Google's arsenal. Not Google Search, though that is significant. Not Gmail, though that is significant too. But Chrome, because Chrome sits between you and the entire internet. Every website you visit, every link you click, every video you watch, every form you fill out, every page you load passes through Chrome before it reaches you. And everything you do online passes through Chrome before it goes anywhere else. Chrome has a front row seat to your entire digital life, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, on every device where it is installed.
And unfortunately, your digital life is now, for all intents and purposes, for most people, your real life. You are, not you people, most are suffering terminal screen addiction. I don't care if it's in your hand or on your desk. It doesn't matter. This is an astounding engine of domination. Self-control must be exercised by all of us, or it will end up shaping us. It will feed us a diet that it knows we enjoy. Okay? Many of you already know all this. I'm just rehashing it for the record.
Now, Google will tell you, and has told you in extensive privacy policy documentation that almost no one reads, that Chrome's data collection is designed to improve your experience, and that there are settings you can use to control what is shared. And technically, both of those statements contain some truth. But the gap between what Google tells you in technical documentation and what most people understand about what Chrome is doing is one of the most significant information asymmetries in modern technology. Let us talk specifically about what Chrome collects and how. The most obvious mechanism is your Google account. If you're signed into Chrome with a Google account, and the browser actively encourages you to do this, then your entire browsing history is synced to Google's servers by default. Every page you visit is logged. Every search you perform is stored. This is not a bug. It is a feature. Google frames it as a convenience. Your bookmarks, history, and passwords follow you across devices. But the flip side of that convenience...
Follow you across devices. Think about it. No matter what computer you're using, it will follow you. And I've had this pop up so many times. To visit this site or to continue viewing this, sign up or log in. And there'll be a Google login page that pops up. Then it's a sign in. Put your password in. Put your whatever. Well, I don't do that. I never have done that. I won't sign up with Google. So I'm not able to see some things. I remember once, two or three years ago? I really wanted to see a particular story. It was very important. So I tried to fill out sign up with Google. And I put in my, what do they call it? Your whatever. You're visiting, you name yourself, you give yourself a name. And then you have to put in a password. Well, I got to the second stage and it wouldn't accept my password. My suggested password. It wanted me to use its password. That was the end. I clicked off. So I am not in the traditional Chrome Google paradigm. Oh, they know. They've got me by name. They've probably got me by my computer, etc. But I will not fill out those, log into Google or fill out this application and then become a Google, that's good. A Google subscriber. No.
Is that Google has a complete time-stamped record of your internet activity linked to your identity. But here is where it gets more complicated and more important. Because even if you are not signed into a Google account, even if you think you are browsing anonymously, Chrome is still collecting data. Google embeds tracking technologies across a vast network of websites through products like Google Analytics, Google Ads, Google Tag Manager, and DoubleClick. These tools are installed on an estimated 85% of the top 10 million websites in the world. That means that on roughly 8.5 out of every 10 websites you visit in Chrome, Google has code running.
Wow. 8.5 out of every 10. Google has code running. We're not surprised, are we? Nah, we shouldn't be.
Here on that page and report it back to Google servers, even if you never signed into a Google account and never used Google Search.
See, I have no Google account. I have used Google Search, but I haven't signed in for it. So they've got you. It doesn't matter. It doesn't.
The implications of that for a moment. You open Chrome. You navigate to a news website. Google Analytics is installed on that news website, tracking what articles you read and how long you spent on each one. You click over to a retail website. Google Ads, is installed there, tracking what products you look at and how far down the page you scroll. You visit a health information website. Google Tag Manager is running there, observing what medical topics you are researching. None of these sites are Google. You never went to google.com. But Google has visibility into all of it because the tracking infrastructure is embedded across the web like a nervous system, and Chrome is the body through which most of the world navigates that web. This is what researchers and privacy advocates call the surveillance advertising ecosystem, and Google is its dominant operator. The data collected across this network is aggregated, analyzed, and used to build detailed profiles of billions of individuals, profiles that include inferred characteristics like political leanings, religious beliefs, health concerns, financial stress levels, relationship status, and psychological vulnerabilities. These profiles are not just used to show you ads for products you might buy. They are used to determine what information you see, what prices you are offered, what content is recommended to you, and in increasingly documented ways, they influence political advertising and information targeting in ways that have real consequences for democratic processes. Now, let us talk about something that Chrome...
That was very good. Is this an AI script, okay? AI writes better than most people. Not all, most. AI can sing better than most people now. What's that guy, the Black Soul guy? I can't remember his name. Number one song on Apple Music. Also two more in the top 10, three out of the top 10 slots. This is shades of things to come. It's better than we are. Admittedly, AI is running at about 150 human IQ equivalency. It's much higher than that. Don't believe it. It's higher, and it's exponentially moving in the direction of absolute master to serf. It's going there.
Does that very few users are aware of, something that Chrome's own engineers have documented, and that privacy researchers have studied extensively. It is called the Google Privacy Sandbox, and it is one of the most consequential developments in browser history that almost no one outside of the tech industry has heard of. For decades, the primary mechanism that advertisers used to track users across the web was the third-party cookie. A cookie is a small piece of data that a website stores in your browser. First-party cookies are fine. They are how websites remember that you are logged in, what is in your shopping cart, your language preference. Third-party cookies are different. They are placed by companies other than the website you're visiting, primarily advertising companies, and they allow those companies to follow you from website to website, building a profile of your behavior across the entire web over time. This is the technical foundation of cross-site tracking. Third-party cookies have been criticized by privacy advocates for years, and browsers like Firefox and Safari began blocking them by default several years ago. Google announced that Chrome would also phase out third-party cookies, which sounded like a privacy win. But what Google actually built to replace third-party cookies is, depending on who you ask, either just as problematic or potentially more problematic. Because instead of advertisers tracking you individually across the web, Google proposed that Chrome itself would analyze your browsing behavior and assign you to interest groups, and then share those interest group labels with advertisers, all within the browser. The data technically never leaves Chrome, but the result? Advertisers, knowing that you belong to categories like health-conscious consumer or financially stressed individual or politically conservative voter, is functionally similar to what third-party cookies enabled. Privacy researchers at organizations like the Electronic Frontier Foundation and academics at major universities have raised serious concerns about this approach, arguing that it gives Google even more centralized control over the advertising ecosystem because now the browser itself is doing the targeting and Google controls the browser. Instead of opening up competition and improving privacy, critics argue the privacy sandbox cements Google's dominance. This is the subject of ongoing regulatory scrutiny from competition authorities in the United Kingdom, the European Union, and the United States Department of Justice. And speaking of the Department of Justice, let us talk about where Google stands legally right now, because this context is essential for understanding why the conversation about Chrome alternatives is not just a niche tech enthusiast discussion, but a mainstream one.
Okay, we're going to have to stop there. When we do our next AI update, I'll carry on with this so we'll know what the three suggested browsers are. I don't know. I didn't get that far. But we'll find out. I use Safari for whatever that's worth. It's the default on the Mac Mini I have as my baseline computer. I've had Mac Minis since I think they first came out. And no problem with them. They're small. They're powerful, and they do a good job. It's the people on the other end. It's not the tech that I'm looking at and interacting with. There's a whole nother universe on the other side of that. Think about it as the other side of the coin. The people who work in that dark world, the denizens of that dark world, are not my friend. They're out to take from me all kinds of things. And with more and more people who used to be in the middle class finding themselves with no discretionary income, the fight to get every dollar is now more bloodthirsty than it ever has been before. Okay, that'll do it for our AI update. Sorry about not able to get our guest, but we'll keep working on it. It's that group that doesn't want information and truth out there. Okay, back with more in just a few. Hang on.